Our last case of the morning is number 023425, the United States against Cortez Gillum. Mr. Moat?
May it please the court, my name is David Moat, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant Cortez Gillum. And our issue is whether the district court was incorrect in denying Mr. Gillum's motion to suppress. As the court's aware, we had that one issue encompasses three subparts here. Before I discuss them in more detail, there's some quick points I would like to make. One is that in this case, there was a problem, the district judge found, with every item listed in the warrant. Some items the judge struck because they were overbroad or overly vague. The items that she found were specific enough and, in essence, upheld under Leon, she found were lacking in probable cause. Second point I wanted to make is that in discussing whether there's good faith here, the government says that there's good faith because the police officer getting the warrant did everything he could reasonably be expected to do. He took the warrant to an assistant state's attorney, and then it was taken to the judge who signed off on it. What the government ignores, as the Zimmerman case states, is that to have a reasonable belief in the warrant, the officer has to have a reasonable knowledge of what the law prohibits. And Detective Carpenter, by his testimony, clearly did not. He testified that he only learned that day, the day of the hearing, that the Fourth Amendment prohibited general warrants. Next point I wanted to make, the government argues in, I think, a footnote that the court applied an objective test for good faith, and in support of that they cite the judge saying that the test is what a reasonable officer would believe, but they ignore what the judge actually said in concluding that Detective Carpenter acted in good faith. And what she said was, Detective Carpenter said he certainly felt he did have good cause there. And then she continued, I frankly don't doubt Mr. Carpenter's integrity in this instance. We don't doubt Detective Carpenter's integrity either. But what Judge Scott did was accept that he said, I thought this was good enough. And that is a subjective rather than an objective test. Another thing the government says in its brief is that nowhere in the record is it indicated that any police officer told Alty Gillum that they were declining his consent, and therefore they imply that there's no basis in the record for it. But the government notes that consent doesn't have to be written, and consent can in fact even be nonverbal, and they ignore the transcript in the suppression hearing, which is replete with information showing that by what was said by the officers, even if not said directly to Mr. Gillum, and by what they did, their conduct, they declined his consent. Page 10 of the suppression transcript shows that Officer Fisher said that he testified, he told Alty Gillum, that they wanted his consent and that he, Fisher, had consent forms in the vehicle. And according to Fisher, Alty Gillum told him that he was willing to consent. Page 17 of the transcript, Fisher indicates he contacted Detective Carpenter, who was getting the warrant, to tell him that, and Carpenter told him, in essence, don't bother, we've got a signed warrant. Detective Carpenter, at pages 41 and 42 of the suppression hearing transcript, testifies that he told Fisher that they had the warrant and the signed consent was not necessary, and also that when he arrived, he, which is at this point Altie Gillum, has been waiting and kept out of his own residence for 35 minutes, he simply handed Altie Gillum a copy of the search warrant, letting Mr. Gillum know what they had authority to do. The government is correct that we have no authority that we cite regarding this. Frankly, I was unsuccessful in finding cases addressing police doing a search and refusing a consent by a person to do the search. It seems a bit of an odd thing to do. Accepting the consent would have put them with the warrant in a belt and suspenders kind of situation, but that's not what they did. The government also discusses on the question of whether Cortez Gillum's statement was fruit of any problem with the search, discusses a particular phone call between Detective Carpenter, who is now at the residence with the warrant, and Inspector Morrissey with the state police, who is interviewing Cortez Gillum, and they say from that the information relayed by Carpenter doesn't lead to the statement, but they ignore the fact that the record is clear that there are several phone calls between Carpenter and Morrissey, according to Carpenter, while Carpenter is at the residence, and that time period is when they are searching the residence. And it is clear from the record, the statement from Cortez Gillum about where the firearm is found is made after Carpenter has relayed to Morrissey that they have found a firearm in the residence. The last quick point I wanted to make, I think it's page 27 of the government's brief, the government states that the officers who saw Cortez Gillum run into the residence knew that he had shot and killed his brother and were going to ask about that, going to ask about the gun anyway. Factually, that's just not supported by the record. The record is clear that Inspector Morrissey, who testified at the suppression hearing, is an officer with the Illinois State Police in Collinsville, and he is the one who is familiar with the homicide investigation down there, and he is the one who is questioning Cortez Gillum. There is no evidence that anyone in the Springfield Police Department was aware that that homicide involved a gun. There is no evidence that the officer who actually saw Cortez Gillum run into the residence, who was a Springfield police officer named Bivens, was aware of the homicide, of any homicide investigation at that time. There is evidence that a Springfield officer who came in the record into the residence and identified Cortez Gillum knew he was a suspect in a homicide, but one of the problems that Judge Scott identified with the warrant was the fact that there was simply no evidence that Detective Carpenter, and I would say there's no evidence that any Springfield police officer, was aware that homicide involved a firearm, and certainly the information presented to Judge Zappa, State Court Judge Zappa, who issued the warrant, gave him no basis to authorize a search for firearms and ammunition. And even had it been known that the homicide involved a firearm, the fact of the matter is the homicide was 10 days earlier, 100 miles away, and the record shows that no one had seen Cortez Gillum with a firearm in Springfield, Illinois. And with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moat. We'll hear now from Mr. Gilmore.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Greg Gilmore for the United States. Your Honors, Mr. Moat first talked about whether the Court applied an objective or a subjective test. Now, the Court's statement was, so the question turns more on whether a police officer, such as Officer Carpenter in this case, would have a good faith basis to feel that he had a valid warrant once Judge Zapp assigned the search warrant. She didn't say the question is whether Officer Carpenter did or whether he did personally, but whether a police officer. Now, it's true she states that she doesn't doubt his integrity. It's true that she found that he wasn't lacking in honesty. But the fact of the matter is, her words show that she was applying an objective test. Now, Mr. Mote also complains about the consent and tries to make the leap, I think, from whether the Springfield PD indicates to the Illinois State Police, all right, you've gotten verbal consent. Don't bother getting a written consent on your forms. I have the search warrant. I'm on my way over. I'll be there in 30 minutes. That is different than when somebody says, I'll consent, and you say, no, we're refusing your consent. There's consent and there's written consent. They had consent. They don't have to get written consent on an Illinois State Police form. Just because they decline to then have a written consent or a videotape consent or some other evidentiary foundation for that consent doesn't mean there was not consent. The court found there was consent. She credited the officer's testimony, that is, Special Agent Fisher of the Illinois State Police, when he spoke to Alty Gillum, the defendant's cousin, and he said he had, quote, no problem, end quote, with consenting. Later, Alty Gillum, after the guns are found, he's interviewed at the police station, and he reaffirms that he gave consent. He says that to Springfield Detective Kolar. The district court credited that testimony, found it credible, and that is the consent we're talking about here. Now, Mr. Mote says they would not have asked about the gun if they hadn't found the gun. The fact of the matter is there's conversation back and forth, and so that tells us that they confronted the defendant with this information of finding this gun. Well, that's simply not the case. It is true they were talking back and forth. It is true there were two separate ongoing investigations. We've got the one where the defendant is a suspect in a homicide, out-of-town homicide in East St. Louis, Washington Park area. And then we've got the action that happened that morning on October 10th. The homicide is October 2nd, 2001. The action that morning with the arrest and fleeing the stolen car, that's October 10th. Now, I think that Detective Carpenter's indication to Illinois State Police Special Agent Fisher to not bother getting the written consent, we've got the warrant, speaks volumes to at least his belief, and I know it's an objective test, but speaks volumes to what an experienced homicide detective, which Detective Carpenter was, 8 years on the force, a detective with a major case unit, what he felt and what the police felt. After he had put together this affidavit, the application and the search warrant, he presented it to an assistant state's attorney. That person reviewed it and found that it met muster. It was then brought to the chief judge of the circuit court, Judge Zappa. He reviewed it. He signed it. Then Detective Carpenter has this indication that we have consent, we don't need the warrant, and his response is, don't worry about getting these forms filled out. Don't worry about that. We've got the warrant. I'm on my way. Did they act reasonably, the police? Yes, they did. See this defendant run into this apartment, fleeing a stolen car, walk into the apartment, he's stripped down to his underwear. They don't rummage through the apartment at that time. They secure the apartment, post somebody outside, and take the steps that this court wants police officers, and we all want police officers to do, and that is to have a judicial officer review the situation and decide if there's probable cause, a legal basis to search this residence, this apartment. And that's exactly what they did. Now, Mr. Mote cites the, I believe it's pronounced Riccardelli case and the Weber case, the Ninth Circuit and the First Circuit case. I think significantly this case is different from those. Those both deal with child pornography cases, anticipatory search warrants, where law enforcement controls what occurs, basically. They control the search warrant. They control the investigation. In the Riccardelli case, they talk about how the police or law enforcement had an indication of this suspect from a 1975 memo of a distributor of child porn who had listed this person's name, and it wasn't until 1988 that they took any action. In other words, they delayed it 13 years, then got an anticipatory search warrant, which they failed to make a nexus between the receipt of the items and the person's home. But basically, it was a controlled setting that the law enforcement officers controlled. Weber is similar, not quite that long of time spread. It's more in the area of 2 years. However, there's no indication that the defendant in that case ever ordered any child pornography. He just had something sent towards him that was intercepted. They notified him he could pick it up. He declined. There was no indication he ever ordered or had any connection to it. In those cases, the courts both talk about, the First and Ninth Circuit, talk about how there's a lack of time pressure, police control the timing. It's different than our case. It's different because, in this case, Cortez Gillum, the defendant, controls the timing. He's the one that fled that stolen car. He's the one that ran into that apartment, and he's the one that shed his clothes. Now, this case, I believe, is more similar to Brown, the case that we cite in our brief. Also, this court's most recent opinion, U.S. versus Langford, which this court decided on December 31st, that's Westlaw 31890721. That's the case where a warrant was issued for a residence when there was a small amount of evidence indicating the possession of marijuana. And then the police obtain a search warrant for marijuana dealing and find evidence concerning that. We have a similar situation. There's no allegation that the issuing judge abandoned the neutral role. There's no indication or allegation even that the police acted in bad faith or lied or misled the issuing judge who issued the search warrant. There's just the finding later by a reviewing court that there was not probable cause. However, Leon, good faith applies. Your Honors, if there aren't any questions, I'll have a seat. Thank you, and I ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmore. We'll make that a complete minute, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just two quick things. At page 40 of the appendix, Judge Scott indicates, page 17 in the appendix, page 80 of the transcript, Judge Scott indicates that she says, I agree that the government didn't rely on his consent at the time they executed the search, but I think the fact that they could have is sufficient to further validate the search on that basis. So the judge found they didn't rely on it. Also, in Fisher's testimony at appendix pages 24 and 25, he indicates that after his conversation with Carpenter, he's in the conversation with Carpenter after he's gotten consent, he is told, don't bother getting the signed consent. There's no indication that he has walked away from Alty Gillum at that point, that Alty Gillum isn't hearing this radio call. And Fisher testifies it's a radio call to Carpenter, where Carpenter says, don't bother, I've got the warrant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moat. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.